You're listening to Royalton Community Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Food Talk Radio, coming to you from the campus of Vermont Law School in South Royalton, Vermont. This program is a collaboration of the students in the Food and Agriculture Law Society and the Center for Agriculture and Food Systems here on our campus. In our second episode, we'll check in with Emily Lane and Emily Lyons for the latest headlines in food and agriculture news. Emma Hempstead will be interviewing Bridget Croak of the organization Purpose, and they'll discuss social media and its role in coalition building and activism. We'll feature a discussion with Roger Albee, former Secretary of Agriculture for the state of Vermont and former Executive Director of the USDA Farm Services Agency. They'll be speaking with Emily Lane about Vermont's unique position in the world of agriculture and why Vermont is so well suited to fill that role. Noah Sapsi will be speaking with Vermont Law School professor Pam Vesselin to discuss the current state of farm animal welfare. But first, Center for Agriculture and Food Systems Director Lori Restino will be interviewing Geo Honeyford of Hurricane Flats Farm here in South Royalton, Vermont. They'll be discussing how Geo got his start in the farming business and the impact of Hurricane Irene on his farm's land and particularly the soil.
So I should probably introduce you. Geo, and how do you pronounce your last name?
Honeyford.
Honeyford. Okay, cool. And what is Geo short for? Is it George or
short for Tom.
And you own Hurricane Flats.
Right.
So can you tell us a little bit about what you do?
We have a little bit of a diversified operation. We don't do anything in the realm of animals very much. We have a few for ourselves, but we have about 10 acres of mixed vegetables. We do it all organically. And then last year we did about 120 acres of hay. And we sell most of the stuff direct to the customers. We don't do much wholesaling, so I have a farm stand, and then we sell at two farmers markets. Stuff can be found anywhere, but it's usually just bought around this area. I sell some stuff to the law school as well.
So how did you get started?
I grew up in a farm community. My parents are the first generation off the farm. The real spark for me is I was in the Peace Corps, and the assignment they gave me was working with farmers in Sierra Leone on the west coast of Africa with swamp rice production. And the first crop of rice I helped a farmer grow, it was so cool. Right then I said, I'm going to do this. I don't know what I'm going to grow. I just want to grow something. Thinking about it more, I realized that to come back and be a large grain cash farmer in Ohio or Illinois was inconceivable because I didn't have the money to buy the equipment or the farm. Really, the only realistic way of getting into it was small vegetable production.
So how'd you end up in South Royalton?
My wife's from New England. I met her in the Peace Corps, so she brought me to New England. And then I ended up working on an organic farm in Norwich. So that's and then once you get exposed to Vermont, either you love it, you want to stay, or you're out of here.
Right.
So we decided we were going to stay.
Great. So do you own your land here?
Yes.
Or in the 120 acres that you have, do you rent that, or do you own that too?
No, we rent most of it. It's actually
a lot of acreage.
I guess it'd be considered a free lease. When I first came here 15 years ago, it was a half-half split. The person who mowed your field gave you half the hay, and they kept half the hay. Now, for most of the fields around here, I mow your field, I get all the hay.
No.
I don't pay you any money. A lot of these people have, a few horses on the side, so if we're making 1,000 bales off their fields, we give them the hay that they need for their horses. So they get that off it, but we don't pay them any money. But a lot of that, we're going to cut back on that. The hay market has slimmed down this past year.
Why is it slimmed down?
I suspect it's because of the economy dumped animals. And a lot of the small 1-2 horse people that I used to sell to are not there anymore. So we're going to scale back. We went from, this year we probably made 7,000 square bales, and next year we'll probably drop down to 4,000.
When you consider what the major obstacles are to people who want to start farming, especially small diversified operations, what do you think those are?
Well, I think expensive land is truly a killer. If you were going to buy your own land, I bought in about 17 years ago, and I considered it expensive when I bought in, but my land has at least tripled in value. A lot of it's because of improvements we've made, but some of it's just the natural course of things. So I think it's very difficult for someone to come in without some resources and buy land. However, land is available, like I was just saying, that I'm paying all these fields. I don't pay any rent. So you certainly can rent land around the state. The problem with renting land is you build it up, you work on it, and at any point in time,
It
could go away.
Right.
It could be housing lots, or the person it could get sold, and the next person's not interested. Or
can you speak to that a little bit when you talked about building up the land? Some people may not understand what you mean by that. You're talking about the soil fertility you know, doing rotational grazing or whatever you're doing. You're really there's a whole kind of biodynamic associated with that.
So there's micronutrients in your land that maybe you can grow broccoli well, but can't grow a lettuce with the dam.
Yeah.
And so try as I may, I can't grow blueberries. They just die. So these are all things you learn over time.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of in that process because Irene last year hit us pretty hard. Mm. So I'm in sort of that same boat because a third of my area, I have basically brand new soils. So last year was a big learning curve for me trying to figure out how much fertilizer do I put down. I don't even know.
So what happened? Did you get flooded out and the topsoil got washed back into the river?
No, actually. Down by the river, we had some washouts on the bank. Huge areas that just got cavernous. But across the field, we had a net gain. And so I have some areas I had 3 feet of deposit.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's, in essence, I had my choice to scrape it all off, or that's my new starting point. It didn't make any sense to me to scrape it all off, use all that diesel fuel. A lot of expense. We were looking at, you know, $25,000 to scrape it all off.
Oh, so wow.
This is my new starting point. I'm basically building the soil back up again.
Right.
Imagine taking your garden soil and just putting it through a massive washing machine. And you washed out all the organic matter, all the little pieces of humus, everything that actually makes soil soil. And you just leave the minerals behind. The minerals are a great catalyst and become good soil. But you need all that humus and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's what I don't have right now. But I'll build that up over the next bunch of years. And so that's what a rookie farmer would do on a new plot of ground is build up those soils. And then to spend 2 or 3 years building them up, getting them to where you want it, and then somebody takes it away. That's why most farmers ultimately seek to own their own land so they can control their own destiny that way. And it's a point of pride that you took something and built it up.
I think a lot of people don't realize how productive you can be if you build up your soils and you use your resources correctly, that you can really get a lot off of 10 acres.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know how to measure it. I guess I'm sure someone's done the math on what you can get off a 10-acre piece like that, but I could feed hundreds of people. I mean, we're taking in late summer, we're taking 5, 6, 8 pickup truckloads a day, just loaded down with stuff off the fields. I've never sat down to measure it.
Mm-hmm. That's enough. That's a good, you just eyeballed it for us. Yeah, it's a lot. So, last and final words before we break.
Yeah, thanks for breakfast. How's that?
That's wonderful, and it was my great pleasure.
All right, guys. Great. Right. Thanks for doing this.
Hello, this is Emily and Emily. Welcome to Food and Agriculture News. Here's what's been happening internationally, nationally, and locally here in Vermont. On March 15th, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe announced his country's intention to participate in negotiations to enter the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This partnership would reduce trade barriers between the United States and Japan, as well as provide an expanding market for American food and agricultural products. The UN reported that world water availability will become progressively more scarce as the world population increases. Water use in farming will rise from 70 to 90% through 2050 as food demand doubles. Pascual Cedudos from the UNFAO Food and Agriculture Organization, stated that this will strain the world water supply as 1 liter of water is required to provide every kilocalorie of food. A UNFAO senior economist stated that the world food prices hit their highest in 6 months since September. World food prices have increased 1.4%, but demand has not decreased. Tennessee and 9 other states are currently considered so-called ag gag bills that prevent undercover videotaping of agricultural operations without consent of the owner. 6 other states currently have similar laws on the books. NOAA-funded scientists say New England can anticipate a red tide caused by an algae which produces a toxin that can cause paralytic shellfish poisoning. This will affect New England commercial fisheries and recreational fishers. A bipartisan group of senators is close to reaching an agreement on a comprehensive immigration bill that will allow for a 13-year path to citizenship for illegal immigrants. The legislation would install new criteria for border security, allow more high and low skilled workers to enter the U.S., and hold businesses to higher standards to verify the legality of their workers' immigration status. The USDA Agricultural Marketing Service recently proposed a new country of origin labeling rule, which attempts to put the U.S. in compliance with WTO agreements. Please see the USDA AMS website for more information about the rule and the commenting process. FSMA, the Food Safety Modernization Act, which will attempt to proactively avoid foodborne illnesses, will affect growers, packers, and processors in the coming years. Members of the food and ag industry will have the opportunity to submit comments based on the proposed rules until May 16th.
House Bill 112 and Senate Bill 89, requiring the labeling for foods containing genetically engineered genes, have been proposed this session in the Vermont State Legislature. On March 1st, the House Agricultural Committee passed H-112 with a vote of 8-3. The bill should move to the Judiciary Committee this week, but will be competing for time with a number of other bills. Governor Shumlin and the Ag Secretary, Ross, announced a statewide CSA program to support local farmers. This program seeks to see more local food consumed in Vermont, grow consumer awareness around the diversity and quality of food available, and increase participation in CSA programs throughout Vermont. In extremely local news, to get a plot in the South Royalton Community Garden, please see Jenny Lane, who can be reached at 802-763-7740, extension 208, or jlane at soberschool.org. Allotments are available on a first-come, first-served basis. And also, here are the times and locations for the Windsor County Winter's Farmers Markets. In Heartland, there's the Heartland Winter's Farmers Market open on Friday. Ludlow's Farmers Market opens Saturday, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Masonic Lodge. The Norwich Farmers Market, which is open the second Saturday of each month from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Tracy Hall on Main Street. And the Sharon Winter's Farmers Market takes place on Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Sharon Elementary School. For other farmers markets in Vermont, see vermontagriculture.com.
And now for a quick update on the Farm Bill. The outlook for Congress to pass a new Farm Bill is bleak. The United States Department of Agricultural Programs was threatened with budget sequestration. However, Congress approved and sent to the White House a stopgap spending bill, which will continue funding to agencies until September 30th. That's all for Food and Ag News. Tune in next time for more information.
So this is Bridget Croak from Purpose talking about changing the world.
No problem.
All right. She can do it.
Easy, yeah. So one of the things that we talk about at Purpose when we're trying, you know, just to kind of back up and give a little bit of our philosophy on being able to drive participation around social change is that very often when you're asking people to do something around a social issue, we tend to have very high barrier asks of people up front. So you're asking, you know, very often if you go to a website of an NGO or something, so for instance, just to rag on somebody, we've been working with the Nature Conservancy, and they have this really interesting water program, and water is really fascinating because it's something that's so prevalent and so relevant to people's lives. But even, you know, really kind of deep environmentalists often like don't have a sense that water is really an issue. I live on a mountain in Vermont, and my husband, because we have a river, you know, right next to us, doesn't believe that he has to conserve water. So there's like these very like visceral things that people don't understand. So they're trying to address that. So part of that is the messaging, but the first thing that they ask people to do is to donate. And so right away, they're cutting off this huge swath of people that might engage in something in a lower barrier kind of way. So in terms of kind of getting people to engage either across issues or even along kind of stay engaged on one issue, we have this kind of idea of what we call a commitment curve, where you start with really low barrier asks of people, and then you move them up, you know, progressively as they get more committed. So what you're able to do is if ultimately, you know, you want people to create, you know, you'll have this kind of big bucket of people who might be willing to kind of share a piece of content. They might be willing to sign a petition which is a fairly low barrier ask. And I think one of the critiques of online organizing is that it's called clicktivism, and that people are just clicking and it's really easy and then they can, you know, be done and won't be that engaged in the issue. But when done well, you can use that as an entry point or kind of a gateway drug to get them to be able to move into other actions and move up that commitment curve and do things like donate, create their own content, convene or attend events, things that are more offline. So I don't think online organizing or technology as a tool in and of itself is something that's going to change the world, but it has the opportunity to catalyze all of the other things that people have been trying to do for a really long time. The philosophy, you know, stands for shifting them across different issues as well. There's an issue that feels really adjacent, so health and sustainability in food, two things that, you know, have kind of adjacent, somebody's entry point is around health, and you want to shift them to something else that's adjacent, the narrative that you're telling them and how you bring them in, I think, is really critical in making it relevant to kind of that enlightened, self-interested person that they might be, but having a really easy ask to be able to shift them so that they can slowly build up their kind of understanding and commitment to that over time is what we find to be really successful.
Can I ask you a question that's related to that? So this clicktivism idea, I think the only barrier that they can get over is clicking something, that even that's not going to do anything. I had a really close friend that used to work in a senator's office, and she told me what happens to the comments that actually come in, and she told me that if the stack reaches a certain level, we'll present it, and so has Purpose done any sort of campaign that tries to educate people on what happens after the click?
The organization that we have, like we've created this multidisciplinary team of people that is, you know, aren't just either strategists or kind of online organizers, but we've put them together, people who are behavioral, you know, have a behavioral economics background, people who have a user experience background, and design and technology background, so that we can kind of think about this through the kind of the whole, a more holistic lens, where we might have, the petition might be an ask that we have somebody, but the way that you allow somebody to experience that is really critical. So if you're asking them to sign a petition, and that, like, that what's important is a combination of kind of messaging that's within that, so that it feels relevant, so that it has a sense of urgency, so that you're driving them to action. But what happens after that is almost more critical, because if they feel like they did that and they see no results from that, then they're going to feel highly unmotivated to do anything else, like it didn't have a huge impact. So we create kind of a digital portal by which people are taking actions and signing a petition, for example. For us, it's really critical to not only be able to show people that they're not the only one doing that, so have things that show that they, like, how the numbers are increasing over time, and then have report backs that show the actual real world outcomes that have come from that. If there's success on one thing, you can use that to get people excited about the potential for success elsewhere, but also the feedback loop and the fact that, like, you've actually had an impact and this is what has happened. And then, you know, we want to not only kind of drive then that person to stay engaged.
Good day. Emily Lane here, playing you an interview with a very interesting man, and shall we say, pretty high roller, in the world of Vermont's agriculture. Stay tuned to hear what Roger Albee thinks.
So how would you like to introduce yourself?
Somebody who's very passionate about agriculture, Vermont agriculture, regional food systems, and the excitement that's happening today with people wanting to grow food, be connected to their food, know where it's coming from, and be part of the food system.
And you're an expert in the field of food and agriculture, particularly in Vermont, from your experience as the former State Secretary of Agriculture for Vermont,
is that correct? Yes.
And also the Executive Director of the USDA Farm Services Agency.
I've done that in the past as well.
You say that Vermont is experiencing a renaissance in agriculture and food systems.
I tell the story of when I served as Secretary of Agriculture. My mother, who is going to be 97, this was about 4 or 5 years ago, said to me, what are you doing this weekend? And I said, we have a locavore event. And she said, what is that? And I said, it's about local food. And she said, what's new about that? It's a renaissance. It's a renaissance of the past. But it's a nice renaissance. It's a reawakening that's taking place.
This renaissance in agriculture and the resurgence of interest in food and a movement for local food is a national theme at the moment. It's a hot topic. Why is Vermont uniquely situated?
Well, I think it's uniquely situated because its location, a micro zone within a large urban area, and therefore it's always been known for its connection to the land, its beauty, its ability to be unique in many ways. We've always been noted for our maple syrup, the state to certainly pass a bottle bill.
What is a bottle bill?
To charge a fee on returnable bottles. We were one of the first states, I believe, that passed major land legislation through Act 250 that put controls on development, and part of that was because back in the early 60s, some of the development was taking place was bringing great harm to the environment in terms of sewage and water quality and runoff, and we were the first state to do that. So we've always had this really groundswell of protection for the soil, protection for the land, and protection for what we connect with in terms of food systems, agriculture, and working landscape.
In terms of Vermont setting a precedent with their legislation, do you have anything to say about the introduction of H.R. 112?
Most people would say, and certainly I would be those included, that the consumer has a right to know, typically based.
What about access to land? Is it difficult to acquire land here in Vermont?
Well, it's difficult to acquire land in many locations for farmers because the cost of land is one of the biggest cost inputs into any farming operation. Certainly, that's one of the reasons that we have purchase of development rights in terms of programs in the state of Vermont that are handled through basically the Vermont Housing Conservation Board, which gets their funding primarily, almost exclusively, from a transfer tax on land. So that there is funding to buy down the development rights so that young people have an opportunity to have access to land to farm with. But without those kind of programs, it is very hard to have access unless you're born into or marry into or somehow are given the land to use. And that's true nationally as well.
What historically has made Vermont the way it is?
In Vermont, we can all talk to each other, whether we're talking to the governor or our two senators or our congressman or the mayor in the town or the president of the law school. Everyone's accessible. Vermont Council of Rural Development Working Landscape Bill with the legislature and with the governor, and last year they had it passed, which would basically provide funding for ag and forestry development in terms of food systems and forestry enterprises and people who want to be involved in those type of enterprises. And I think one of the things that's very encouraging is when they've done some surveys of the public around a working landscape, 97% of Vermonters want a working landscape because they even put that above healthcare in strange ways. There's just this feeling of when you're in Vermont that you're someplace special. I take what I can get. I take what I'm given.
Hi, I'm here with Professor Veslin.
Thank you for having me. I'm a longtime fan of college radio, and it's good to be back.
Thank you. So we were talking briefly before the start about how people tend to focus on domestic animal abuse, but possibly the cruelest treatment of animals is in large-scale animal agriculture. And at this point, they really have no legal rights.
Okay, so I'm going to start by making sure that we understand that there's a difference between legal rights and legal protections to a point. So I just want to clarify that when I use the word right, that is a different thing. That's, you know, we have constitutional rights, actually, and corporations have constitutional rights, but animals have legal protections. And to a point, some people have considered that to be equivalent to legal rights. But stepping back from that, the way the law addresses animal protection is completely through the lens of how we interact with those animals and why we're interacting with them. Our pets are by far the most protected animals because they're our possession, they're our property, they are our companions. You know, and we see them all the time. And when they're abused, we see that too, right? So, it's, you know, we've made sure that the law really goes far to represent their interests. On the other hand, in the last 50 years or so, agriculture has become so industrialized that animals are no longer considered objects of animal husbandry. They're commodities. If you have enough hogs, you're going to have some die off, and you just assume that's how it works. In complete contrast to our pets, we don't see what goes on in these industrial facilities. Not only that, we enjoy the products of what they give us. Most people eat meat. Most people then have a more complicated relationship with these animals. So the protections for them legally are practically nil. And I think that's not what most Americans believe. People don't want to know where their food comes from. It's easy to not consider it. It's easy to assume the government is protecting these animals. The political will is just simply not there right now on a federal level.
So I've met a lot of people who Mercy for Animals or PETA was what changed their minds. But ultimately, those treatments exposed were legal. How do you think we start to recognize some right to not suffer in other species?
I think how you get people on board is by convincing them it's not a detriment to them to raise the standards for how animals are cared for in agriculture. And animal welfare is intrinsically linked to very human concerns like food safety, environmental safety, the safety of your drinking water, for example, labor interests, immigrant interests, you name it. As far as if you care about anything that has to do at all with food or food production, you don't have to care about animals. But if you want to address so many of the food safety issues, you can either prove how animals are used in those processes, or you're looking at irradiation or something after the fact. I think it's also really incremental. Really, the minority camp is constitutional rights for animals or nothing. That would be beautiful, but I don't see that happening anytime real soon. The other approach is incremental, changing human behavior just a little bit at a time, even if it means partnering with the industry to make changes. You know, it's almost a question of psychology. What you're talking about is behavior modification. It just wasn't that long ago when people smoked cigarettes everywhere. In hospitals, in their houses. Professors would teach classes, lighten up a cigarette. It was just acceptable behavior and nobody thought twice about it. Even if they knew that it wasn't necessarily healthy, it was just an accepted social norm. And as a result of a really massive campaign, eventually people's behavior started to change. Not that I think that eating animals is like smoking necessarily, but I'm thinking about the fact that the law often has to be part of the process.
The anti-smoking movement, interesting to consider. You see in activism two really big divides, one being the top-down versus bottom-up. The anti-smoke thing was really from all angles. There was a morality angle, there was a public health aspect. That was a very cynical, media-savvy model. And it wasn't just about what was right. It was about a lot of manipulative advertising and a lot of money. It might be more practical to play the game.
Fun part about animal law, it's still such a new area that it's all about just getting creative. There are few ways to challenge government actions. You can challenge the way agencies make rules. It's very hard to challenge a law, but there's so much uncharted territory. There are very few really, kings of animal law, but even they are sitting around trying to think of creative ideas. This is the new civil rights. It's not like I'm inviting people to say they're insulted that I'm equating animals with humans. That's not a relevant discussion. But if you're talking about trying to extend legal protections for a population that is exploited, has no voice, has no representation, and is worthy of protection, that's civil rights to me, right? And so I think, the short answer to the question you asked me about 15 minutes ago is yes. I think there are all sorts of ways to do this.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to our second episode. Our show airs on Royalton Community Radio at royaltonradio.org, and you can stream or download our show from the Center for Agriculture and Food Systems page at vermontlaw.edu. And we're available on iTunes. Just search for Food Talk Radio. Food Talk Radio is a production of the Food Radio Collective. We are Will Duane, Emma Hempstead, Jack Hornicle, Emily Lane, Emily Lyons, Noah Sapsi, Liz Spellman, and our faculty advisor is Lori Restino. On our program today, we featured music from Jack Hornicle, Young Yeller, the Second String Band, and playing us out today is Krill. You can follow us on Twitter as well. We are at VT Food Radio. Thanks for listening. Food Talk Radio, farm, table, and everything in between. If I drive for long enough for shit, I'll probably find the answers. If I drive for long enough for shit, I'll probably find the answers. And they'll probably be under a rock.